Please be seated. One of the hallmarks of, or characteristics of, or warning signs of psychological or spiritual or social emotional maturity is self-awareness, knowing thyself. And then perhaps the second beat of that work, that inner and outer work that we do at midlife or sometime in our life, is to get a sense of social awareness, how our individual selves matches up over against our community or culture, or perhaps the communities and cultures of others. And I say that because here we sit on this particular Sunday in the Episcopal Church. We are celebrating one of our major feasts, one of four major feasts of the year, which is called Pentecost. And if any of you know Episcopalians or Anglicans across the face of the earth, across the globe, across the Anglican Communion, you know we are anything and everything but Pentecostal. In the Episcopal Church, we have a very particular way of celebrating Pentecost. It begins and nearly ends with the color red. We dress the clergy, we dress the choir, we dress the altar in red. In some places, we even encourage the lay people of the church to wear red on the day of Pentecost. And at 5:12 this morning, I was digging through my sock basket trying to find the red pair of socks that I wear one time a year out of allegiance to my tribe, Episcopalians and Anglicans. Alas, I did not find them. I'm wearing gray socks today, but they're red on the inside, I promise. We have this institutionalized and domesticated way of celebrating a feast that recalls a story that is anything but domestic. If you heard the story of Pentecost as Anne read it, you know it's a wild story, but we don't even read it that way in the Episcopal Church. We don't read it with like the enthusiasm and vigor of like, what a rushing wind, fire, languages. And we don't, because there's even two levels of institutionalization or domestication that we have. The feast, like most feasts that we have in the Christian church, is borrowed, stolen, or appropriated from our Jewish brothers and sisters. It gets co-opted into Pentecost in our tradition, in theirs. It is the Feast of Shavuot. It's one of three pilgrimage feasts. So in Jesus' day and age, you would have gone from Galilee, the region of Galilee, down to Jerusalem to meet at the temple and to celebrate this holiday at the temple. It is 50 days, hence the word, from Passover, just as our Pentecost is 50 days from Easter. And the celebration where Passover celebrates the liberation of Israel from slavery in Egypt, The festival of Shavuot celebrates the coming of, the bringing of the law to Israel. Like that tool that Israel uses both to connect and stay connected to God, but also to the work of God and one another in the world. So there's sort of a double layer of institutionalization and culturalization and domestication of the the holiday, the celebration, the feast itself that we as Episcopalians and we as spiritually curious people have to reckon with on a day like today. But if we were to pay careful attention to the story itself, to the details of the story itself, it is anything but a domesticated story. It's like everything that we do in the Episcopal Church, we must do like shoulder to shoulder, eyes all facing the same way, doing our thing, and even better if it's done in like a British or Scottish accent. You know, like just to bring that flavor, like no smiling, just like a gentle lift of the corners of our mouths. But the story itself, the details of the story itself are crazy. It begins with the disciples, and it identifies the disciples as coming down from Galilee. We know that they're making their pilgrimage down to the temple. They have, you know, they're in some room together. We might think of it as like their Airbnb in Jerusalem, that they rented a place where they could all be together. And to be clear, they're not all together in a one-off kind of event. They're all together like we are all together at Thanksgiving, or like we are all together at Easter, or like we are all together at Christmas. This is something that they do year in and year out. It's not a one-off experience. They are engaging and embodying a religious social tradition that they have done for likely their entire lives. And they're pressed into the room, and then the story begins. And it begins with the sound of a mighty rushing wind. Here they are in the common room, the open concept design of their Airbnb in Jerusalem, with both kitchen, dining area, and gathering area together. Maybe they're having a cocktail or a cup of tea, and all of a sudden, they can't hear a thing because there is so much wind and noise in the room that it squashes out anything said. It dominates their physical experience one of another. That's the first beat of the Pentecost story. The second beat, not wind, fire! Fire, y'all! Fire! Fire is alighting the top of each of these disciples' head in the common room of their Airbnb in Israel. Wind and then fire. This is a crazy scene. Something magnificent and frightening and beautiful is happening all at the same time. Of course, the learned ear is meant to access the experience of Jesus' baptism in the Jordan by John, when the wind and the voice of God and fire comes down. We're meant to see this as a moment of baptism, a moment of re-baptism of these disciples in the Holy Spirit, which is what both John and Jesus promised in this really dynamic way long ago. Now it's really happening. And then there's this third beat, this beautiful beat that harkens all the way back to Genesis. They begin to speak to each other. They begin to speak to each other in their common language, in their tribal, regional language, languages that the other is not fluent in, and yet they are all understanding one another. This, of course, is an echo back to the story of creation and the 11th chapter of Genesis, the story of the Tower of Babel. Now, it harkens back to the first two chapters in Genesis in this way. What we're meant to see here is a moment of interdependence where there exists in this moment in this room both diversity, difference in language, very real felt embodied difference, diversity in one beat, and at the very same time, ironically or paradoxically, unity. Both diversity and unity in the very same ecstatic moment is happening in this story in such a gorgeous way. And we're hearing it in words, the way that God created in the very beginning of the story, when God's creating creation and then the garden, and the nature of the way that we embodied, the way that we lived in the garden is the embodiment, is the existential orientation of interdependence. Things go wrong when we begin to exercise our independence. Oh, that looks delicious. Even though I'm not supposed to eat it, I'll take a bite because I got this. No, that's not the design. So this story of Pentecost is hearkening back to that. It's also hearkening back to Babel, where, if you remember the story itself, humanity has gone through this great ordeal, this flood, this confusing flood that demolishes humanity and every living creature and the face of creation except that which floats in this boat. And then at the end of the storm, after a promise and a sign of the promise and a rainbow, God issues God's command, go and scatter yourselves across the face of all creation. I'm never going to bring a flood like that ever again. I want all of you to go and to spread out. And what does humanity do? Humanity does what humanity does after a traumatic experience, right? They're like, we're not going anywhere other than together. So they don't spread across the face of the earth. They come together in one place, and they're like, maybe we could build an escalator or an elevator to heaven and be even closer to God. And God's like, no, and he squashes the tower, and he spreads them out across the face of the earth in a beautiful way by giving them all different languages. And then we come full circle to this Pentecostal moment that we're having in Luke's version of the story from Acts, and we get this moment where they still have their different language, but they're bound together as creatures of God, and they're able to connect and relate and interact with one another from their own place of uniqueness or creativity. It is a glorious story. And the first beat of this story is a scene of mass ecstasy. It is a vision that they are experiencing in common. It is a cosmic, mystical, psychedelic experience that these disciples and other witnesses are experiencing firsthand. That's Act 1, Scene 1, curtain. And then there's this beautiful interlude in the story. And this interlude, I think, is very important for us because I believe we, our culture, right now, we're sitting in the interlude of the Pentecostal story. If you listen carefully to the details, after the wind and after the fire and after the language, we turn our attention to those who are on the outside of the circle. And those who are on the outside of the circle are like, man, this is crazy. This is so much craziness that those people experiencing what they're experiencing in the center, like, they must be hammered. The only explanation for what's going on is these people are absolutely wasted. They are high as kites. Because those people from the outside are trying to make sense of what's happening with their minds, But what's happening in the center of the circle is a heart-based experience, not a mind-based experience. They're using the wrong instrument. And when you use the wrong instrument, you're going to get a false conclusion. And they're like, there's no way. These guys, like, whoo, they're hammered. That's the only realistic explanation for what's happening. Close. Scene two, curtain. Curtain opens again. Scene three. We get this gorgeous sermon from Peter, where Peter does his best to bring all of these disparate pieces of a puzzle together in such a gorgeous way. He opens with, nah, I know that it seems that way, but these guys just woke up at 8. It's 9 o'clock in the morning now. They have not had enough time to get drunk. They are not drunk. Rather, they are oriented toward God in such a powerful direction that it's really hard for you to understand as observers using your mind to understand what's going on. And then he does this gorgeous thing where he brings out one of the Hebrews' minor prophets. He begins to quote this prophet Joel. Now, Joel is an interesting character, and we need to know a little bit about Joel in order to understand the sermon that Peter is preaching to Israel in this moment in time. Now, all that we know about Joel's biography is that Joel is the son of Pethuel. And what we are, whenever we hear a proper name or a geographic location in the biblical story, that's like a highlighted word or a word with an asterisk next to it. And we should stop and pause for a second and ask ourselves, like, what is the story trying to tell me here that I'm not quite picking up? And if we cruise back to the interlinear Bible or to the internet or to a Hebrew lexicon, what we would find out is Joel's dad's name is, it means like an openness to God. So anytime there's E-L at the end of a Hebrew name, or frankly, at the end of an English name, Michael, Nathaniel, Gabriel, all those names have their roots in the Hebrew language. That El means of God. And Pate or Peth in this particular instance means like an openness. And so what we're meant to hear is that Joel, this prophet Joel, raised in the belly of Israel, comes from a family that has an open-mindedness when it comes to God. Like, that's his family's, his culture's orientation to God. Thoroughly ensconced in the tradition of Israel, yet open to the movement of God in different and creative ways. And then when we go to Joel, Joel's name is like, basically like God is God. Like Joel has arrived in this place, that the Lord is God, is what Joel says. And there are these two really important beats in the prophecy of Joel that we need, we're meant to recall. Peter repeats one of them, the second one that I'm going to talk about, but the first one is important too. You see, Joel comes to Israel at a particularly challenging time in Israel's life. Joel begins to prophesy to Israel following a devastating famine. There's been a swarm of locusts that have descended upon Israel's crops for years going on, and Israel is desperate. And Israel is embodying the behavior that desperate humans do, disconnecting from their relationship with God, disconnecting from their relationships with one another and looking out only for themselves in this ecological, social, political, economic crisis that is this moment in time. And Joel begins to prophesy to Israel in a very compelling way, encouraging Israel to remember God and to remember one another. And he does that through this human experience that we have whenever we engage in chaos or confusion or tragedy or struggle, in moments of cultural chaos, cultural struggle, cultural tragedy, cultural confusion. Does this sound familiar? I feel like we're in one of those moments in our own cultures right now. And to be clear, as I've said in weeks past, and I will say in weeks to come, I don't care who you vote for. I don't care. What I'm talking about is how we are treating for one another right now in this moment in time. Is it with cruelty and violence, or is it with loving kindness and tender care? Joel is trying to reorient Israel, who has experienced an ecological disaster, a spiritual crisis, and is on the verge of divine renewal in this moment in time. And he starts with this piece of advice that comes from Jewish religious tradition. He says these words, and they'll be familiar to some of you because you hear them repeated in our liturgy throughout the year. He says, "Rend your hearts and not your garments." Joel is referencing this practice, this Jewish practice that surrounded bereavement or grief. If great-grandpa or great-grandma went to heaven and we found ourselves in a moment, in an era, in a season of grief, our practice, our religious practice, would be to shave the hair off our heads and to tear our clothes. And we tear our clothes and we shave our heads so that we might be recognizable. I would tear my clothes and shave my head so that when you encounter me picking out peaches in the produce section of Albertsons, you would know. You would know by just putting your eyes on me that I am sad and I am lost and I am struggling. And that would be a sign for you to come and give me nurture and care in love. And we shave our heads because, like, about the time our hair grows back, grief has turned from the acute phase of grief to the phase of grief where we're able to live with our sorrow. And we're able to integrate our sorrow back into the great joys and all the banalities of our human experience. But Joel has recognized something. He's like, no, don't do it on the outside, Israel. Do it on the inside. You're disconnected from God and from one another. So rend your heart, not your garments. That's the part of Joel's prophecy that Israel would have heard in Peter's speech without him repeating it. And then there are these two other beautiful beats where Peter says, he's quoting Joel and he says, the Spirit has been poured out on all of humanity. This is this universalization of God's love and care and nurture to all of creation. Everyone is able to access it. And then this next beat that he repeats is this beautiful beat where he says, like, your young people, your young men and your young women will prophesy. Now that's a gorgeous moment, right? Because what do we know about adolescence and late adolescence and young adulthood? It's that time in human existence where we need to stand up with our fist in the air and declare what we stand for and what we believe in. And in this prophecy of Joel, we stand for and we believe in one another, the care of each other's souls. It's what young people do. So if you're one of the people who's watching the news and being like, man, those kids at Harvard, those kids at Columbia, like they're just a bunch of terrorists. I'm like, no, they're doing what young people are supposed to do. It's okay, even if it's confusing, right? It's just like what I said to Jade this year on her first year on a college campus. Like, man, try it on, Jade. Get out there, put your fist in the air and see what your heart says. It's okay if it's not pure. Nothing in life is black and white. But what I know about this moment in time, this era in which you live right now as a young adult, this is what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to stand for something in a gorgeous, compelling, impassioned way. And that's not all he says either. He quotes Joel again, and he says, your young people, in this moment, if you lean into what the Holy Spirit is doing in this moment in time, your young people will see visions. Visions of what creation, what life in the here and now could be if it were organized in a loving way. And he says, your old people will dream dreams. Dreams about those moments in their past where they have nurtured and healed and loved and shared kindness across their communities and family systems, and dream bold dreams about the future, how those characteristics, those loving, healing, nurturing characteristics will be embodied by the people who will come after them, who always come after them, who will come after us. It is a gorgeous story, a story that is anything but domesticated and institutionalized. It is decidedly not a traditionally Episcopalian or Anglican story. It is a crazy, wild dream, and we as a church get this opportunity, this annual opportunity to re-engage our spiritual, our social emotional, our psychological lives together, to recast them out of independence into interdependence, out of guarding and nurturing what is our own into a place of collaboration and shared loving kindness. Wow. Like, what a story. A mass ecstatic moment that Luke the evangelist narrates us through the second chapter of Acts. Now, if you're visiting this church, you don't know necessarily about what I'm going to be talking about. Now I'm going to launch our summer theme and do the big reveal. But if you are visiting, let me assure you, like, you can come along for the ride. What we do in this church at every new season, liturgical or otherwise, is we launch a theme. And the theme is meant to guide us, not just individually, but to guide us together in a process where we might meet God and meet one another in a slightly different, new, or fresh way. And the theme that we're going to celebrate at St. John's Episcopal Church in Jackson, Wyoming, and at the Chapel of the Transfiguration in Moose, Wyoming, and wherever else you decide to take it into your living room, back to Vero Beach, Florida, or McLean, Virginia, or wherever you go or are or come from. The theme that we are celebrating this year is rewilding. And the work that we have to do is to rewild these stories that have become so domesticated over time that we miss these details that are hidden in plain sight. And when we miss these details, we fail to get plugged in to the impassioned experience of being Pentecostal Episcopalians, if there is such a thing. There is. There's at least one of us in the room. How about two of us, sister? Yeah. So what you will notice over the course of the summer season is a liturgy that is purposefully redirecting us, meant to shake us out of our traditional mindset so that we might hear things in different ways. Just as you've heard the story today from a different translation of the Bible that we typically hear, you will hear prayers and a Eucharistic prayer that's a little bit different. Now, it is my hope, my sincere hope, that you carry our corporate practice into your lives as individuals. And I know that sometimes it can be helpful to have like a little tool, a token, a reminder of something that can help you make this move in your own life. And so what each of you will get, and you can grab one when you come up to communion, I would ask that you take one for yourself. What each of you will get is what I have been calling an almost magic wand. This almost magic wand has been made for you. It's been made for you from willows that have grown in this valley. And those willows were cut and shaped with care and love and prayer. And at the end of each of these willows, well, you can see there's a little glitter or a little angel dust. Angel dust is probably the wrong term. Not that kind of angel dust. Fairy dust. I was trying to go with the religious thing, though, and avoid fairy dust. So I said angel dust, and then I was like, wow, that's a drug reference. Maybe we shouldn't do that. There's a little bit of almost magic dust on the end of this almost magic wand for you. And I encourage you to use this to help you lean in to this Pentecostal reality. If we think about what's happening as we move from the very tradition to the from the Jewish tradition to the Christian tradition, our Jewish brothers and sisters celebrate the coming, the bringing of the law, their tool for connection to God. And that's disrupted in this moment, in this ecstatic moment where the Spirit rushes in like wind. I want you, I beg of you, I invite you to open yourself up to the reality that whenever you feel the wind on your face, that you know that is the very presence of God engaging you in the physical realm, and not just the physical realm, but also the metaphysical realm. That which chaps your cheeks and your lips is there to care for you and nurture you. And if you need a little help with that, we'll use your almost magic wand. Invite yourself to move out of this place and into this place. If you need a little help being kinder in your speech, ask the almost magic wand and the Spirit that is the power behind it to make your words lovingly kind. If you're listening for God but just can't seem to hear her, maybe on the ears. Maybe on the ears. If you want to do more to help people in your community, to activate your hands. Maybe you touch this almost magic wand to your hands. If you are struggling because of all the compelling content on Netflix and Hulu and Prime to get your tuchus off the couch in order to engage in loving service in your community, maybe you take this wand to your tush. And you say, wand, almost magic wand, Holy Spirit, help me embody the creative and loving power that you brought to the disciples and all the witnesses in this moment of Pentecost. Liberate my domesticated and institutionalized faith in such a way that I might experience you coming from left field rather than from home base. Help me love more courageously. God, I want to see you in the clouds and in the sky and in the stars and in that strawberry moon that comes on Tuesday night and Wednesday morning. Help me experience you in this valley as it goes from brown to green, as the arrowroot comes up and turns it yellow, as we watch the charismatic megafauna of the greater Yellowstone ecosystem make for northern territories. Connect me to your creative power, God. And if I need a tool, let it be this almost magic wand. We, church, will become Pentecostal Episcopalians. We, church, can rewild our faith so that we can reconnect with God's extravagant, creative, and dynamic love in the world. Amen.